Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for a new year of this program as we document the nature of and the challenges posed by our times, existential threats to freedom, and what I call the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to say our first guest in this new year is my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Claire Lopez, our Vice President for Research and Analysis, an extraordinarily accomplished professional with some 20 years of service in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency. She has become one of our country's foremost experts on Iran and the jihad more generally, but it is a particular pleasure to have her with us to talk a bit about the latest developments, quite momentous developments, in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Claire Lopez, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio and a Happy New Year to you. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you and Happy New Year to you too.
Thank you. So, Claire, give us a quick sense of what has been happening during this holiday period on the ground in, it seems, a substantial and growing number of Iranian cities.
Well, what began in the period just after Christmas and between Christmas and New Year's as an uprising of protest about the economy, high prices and the corruption of officials that were held to blame for that, very quickly morphed into a much more generalized uprising against the regime itself. The difference between these protests today and those back in 2009 after the fraudulent election of that year, I think primarily is in scope and numbers of cities involved. Right now, as of the sixth day and counting for these protests, you've got cities, dozens and dozens of cities and towns all over Iran in an uproar. Unfortunately, the death toll has passed 20 that we know of, probably more than that, and hundreds injured, many hundreds under arrest. But what we do see is that there is a difference in the tone of the protesters, and that is, instead of calling for just economic measures, they are now calling outright death to Khamenei, the supreme leader, death to the regime, even death to Rouhani, the president. They are seeking nothing less than regime change at this point.
This is a refreshing change, of course, from the approved calls for death, which have been since 1979, as you know so well, Claire Lopez, death to America and death to Israel. This is a potentially transformative moment, and regime change, if indeed that is the objective, and if the government is unable to suppress this, it could well pose the best opportunity, at least since 2009, when President Obama allowed a similar opportunity, perhaps to slip away, for accomplishing an end to the danger that is posed by this regime. If you were making book on it, Claire Lopez, how realistic is that prospect at the moment?
It's hard to say at this point. Things are still gathering steam. The regime has yet to apply the full force of its security services to putting down the protesters. In part, it apparently seems, from what are alleged to be leaked documents out of the top leadership of the Iranian regime, that they are divided themselves at the top about what to do about the protests and whether cracking down hard would have perhaps an opposite effect of what's intended. Furthermore, I suspect that there is some doubt about the loyalty, even within some of the security services, certainly among police at the local level, perhaps even among more national level security services. So all of that can work to our favor. I think that we have an unmatched opportunity right now with President Trump in the White House. Certainly the bully pulpit, the leadership aspect of President Trump standing in support, openly voicing support via Twitter for the protesters, and their rights to a representative government that's not oppressive and terrorist goes a long way to supporting them. I think in addition, though, one of the most important things that we can ask or should ask the Trump administration to do is to help them, the protesters, with communications. As we know, they were using Instagram and Telegram social media to communicate across the country from city to city. By the way, this is a lot of students involved in this, former and current university students, a lot of it organized under the National Iranian Congress leadership. But they need communications help, and the U.S. government could help with that by providing dedicated bandwidth on a satellite that would be impervious to jamming and blocking.
Yeah. Well, you've had experience in clandestine operations, and I think your insights into what can be done are most needed at this moment, Claire, because it would be tragic in the extreme if these people clearly aspiring to liberate themselves from a regime that not only oppresses them but threatens us were, again, to be allowed to slip away. Claire, let me ask you, as we're talking about Iran, of course, it is a threat not only to its own people and to us, but to our friends and allies in the region. It is becoming more aggressive. You've described on this program and elsewhere the Iranians' ambitions to carve out a Shiite crescent. And the Saudis are clearly very much in the crosshairs of the Iranians at the moment and are pushing back, it seems. Where does that stand, the Shiite crescent gambit? And again, what should we be doing about it?
Well, there are, in a way, two crescents. If you might think of the geography of the region there, one is a land bridge, which is all but established now, that runs from Iran's territory itself through Iraq, on up through that desert area that crosses the border with what used to be called Syria, and over to the Mediterranean itself. The other crescent or encirclement, really, if you will, that the Saudi regime sees as so threatening, and rightly so, is a geographic encirclement by puppet regimes and terror proxies of the Arabian Peninsula itself. Baghdad is a puppet regime of Tehran, and then on down to the Iranian support for the Houthi rebels in Yemen, which of course puts the very strategic Bab al-Mandeb Strait between the Arabian Peninsula and Africa at threat. So two different kinds of crescents in a way, but they're aimed not just at encirclement of Israel, which pretty much took place a long time ago from Gaza to Lebanon and around, but now encircling the entire Arabian Peninsula. And I think that the Saudi leadership, certainly under the very dynamic Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is fully aware of this and is unbelievably in discussions with the Israelis about it and with us. The Trump administration, too, should be, I think rightly so, working with the Saudis to counter what is the greater threat of the jihadist regime in Iran, simply because they are on the verge of deploying deliverable nuclear weapons.
Indeed. Claire, very quickly, we have had something else break in the interval of the Christmas holidays, and that was a story in Politico about President Obama's essentially shutting down an effort by the drug enforcement agencies and other elements of the U.S. government to counter the Iranian proxy group Hezbollah, as it was running drugs into this country by the tons, raising money for their operations and otherwise threatening us. I just wonder, Claire, looking back on the legacy of Barack Obama in this connection and the Obama bomb deal and the whole notion that we could, in fact, cozy up to the Iranians and normalize that regime, just very quickly, your reading on it as we look at it today.
Well, you know, we've known for a very long time about the expanding presence of both Iran through its diplomatic missions and Islamic centers it has established, as well as commercial firms and other things in Latin America, as well as where it always goes in partnership, the Hezbollah presence throughout Latin America, South America in particular, but on up now with drug trafficking through Central America. Hezbollah, long known to be allied with Mexican drug cartels like the Zetas, like the Sinaloa, like the Gulf cartels, and those in collaboration running guns, running drugs, running who knows what across the southern border of the United States with Mexico.
A frightening security issue for all of us. Claire, we have to leave it at that, but I think it's fair to say that this legacy of the Obama years is going to be a bitter and potentially very dangerous one for us. Thank you for the terrific work you do for us at the Center for Security Policy. Claire Lopez, our Vice President for Research and Analysis. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us often in 2018. Next up, Elaine Donnelly joins us. We'll talk about another troubling development, the attack on the United States military from federal judges. What on earth is up with that? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, I am thrilled to say, by a woman whom I regard as one of the real heroes in the war for the free world, largely unsung because the work she does is not generally understood or certainly appreciated by most people outside of our military. And that is the work that Elaine Donnelly at the Center for Military Readiness performs to support the military and its culture against the efforts by those who are, well, I guess at best indifferent to both, and at worst wish them ill, to keep social experimentation or engineering from essentially breaking the only military we have. This has been a tough couple of weeks for those of us who care about the sorts of things Elaine Donnelly works on, and I'm very pleased to have her with us to talk a bit about what has happened with respect to this issue of transgenders in the military. There's much more on all of this at her superb website, cmrlink.org, and I commend it to you, but we'll talk with her about it now. Elaine Donnelly, thank you so much for joining us. A happy new year, despite it getting off to a somewhat rocky start.
Happy new year to you too, Frank, and thank you for that kind introduction. Yes, we need to talk about what really happened here over the Christmas New Year's weekend. Four federal district court judges and two courts of appeals have ordered the Department of Defense to recruit persons identifying as transgender starting on New Year's Day yesterday. The Department of Justice failed to file an immediate emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they used as their excuse a reference to a pending Defense Department study of the issue. This is a dereliction of duty because it doesn't hit the main point at all. Under Article 3 of the United States Constitution, the federal courts have no authority to make policy regarding the military. So the Department of Justice should have protected the constitutional rights of the president by filing this emergency appeal. They've done it before in other national security issues.
They did it, in fact, at the appellate level. So it was inexplicable why they weren't doing it at this level. Elaine, you've just described a dereliction of duty. This is all the more remarkable insofar as the president himself, first with a tweet and then in a direct order to the military, said, we're not going to enlist transgender individuals. Where do the courts get off saying that, we are? And secondly, how could it possibly be that neither the Justice Department, nor the Defense Department, nor the Department of Homeland Security, nor the National Security Council, nor the Chief of Staff of the White House or the Counsel to the President seemingly thought this was a constitutional crisis?
It is a constitutional crisis. The issue is not just the military transgender policy alone, but who gets to decide what the policy will be. By failing to petition the Supreme Court for a stay after they did file for appeal at the appeals court level, in essence, the Department of Justice has tacitly conceded that federal judges can make military policy and establish medical standards for enlistments. There is a study pending, and guess what? It's being done by an Obama holdover, a man named Anthony Curta. He was one of the architects of the transgender policy that President Trump has said he wants to first study and then revoke in various ways. So President Trump should ask some questions here. Why did Secretary Mattis assign this Anthony Curta, the Obama holdover, with a record of LGBT activism both before and after the Trump inauguration, to chair this so-called panel of experts that is supposed to produce a report and recommendations on this issue by February 21. Another question is, why does the Justice Department think the courts will view the result of that study, if that's what you want to call it, more favorably than the pro-transgender RAND report that came out under Barack Obama? And why have the Justice Department attorneys just conceded the point that judges have the right to decide enlistment standards? And here's another thing. If this is being done under court order, and it is, why, instead of making plans for what kind of underwear transgender recruits should wear at the military entrance processing stations called the MEPS, they're making plans in excruciating detail what kind of underwear to wear. What they should be doing, and should have done already, is have conditions in the enlistment contract saying, we're doing this under court order. We're going to pursue litigation. If later on the litigation says that we do have the right to change policy, that contract will be void, the person will be released from active duty, and any subsequent applications for accession or enlistment, reenlistment, will be processed in accordance with the policy of the current administration.
This is so incredible to me that that kind of essentially safety net wouldn't be put into place just as a matter of protecting the institutional latitude for addressing changed circumstances down the road. It just seems malfeasant. Let me bring you back, Elaine Donnelly, quickly to something that you said earlier, though, because I think what's so troubling to me is that the precedent of having federal judges interpose their objections to and effectively, if I can use the expression, trump those of the directions of the president, what's to say it'll stop with who's allowed to be in the military? Why would it not also be the case that some federal judge somewhere in the judiciary wouldn't say, oh, I have objections to what the president intends to do with the people that we've let into the military? I mean, where does this stop?
It doesn't stop. The excuse that we're waiting for a study is as lame as, let's say the 2016 Trump campaign allowed the Federal Election Commission to declare Hillary Clinton the winner of the presidential race early on election night, relying on vote counts later to undo that result. Once you go down this road, it's pretty hard to undo the damage. The Department of Justice, where's the strategy to fight and win? On principle. And the principle is that under the United States Constitution, that the president has powers in Article 2, Section 2, that says the president makes policy for the military. He is commander-in-chief. Judges, Article 3, nothing. They have no power to make policy. Where is the strategy to fight and win on that principle? And the second principle is that any change should improve mission readiness and combat lethality. How does obsessing about what kind of underwear people wear at the MEPS improve combat readiness and combat lethality? It doesn't. Everyone knows it. But there are those in the administration who want to cave.
One of the reasons why they're obsessing about the underwear is that there will be people of the opposite sex in the showers, in the bathrooms, in the barracks of their counterparts. It's just unbelievable. And again, it seems to me on the face of it, and this is again why your work at the Center for Military Readiness is so vital, Elaine, it seems so manifestly at odds with what we want the military to be doing and what we need them to do, for heaven's sake. I just wonder, as we're looking at this, you've taught me a lot about gender dysphoria. Just very quickly, what is the condition that these people are manifesting, and why is that inconsistent with readiness of our military as well as good order and discipline?
Until recently, gender dysphoria, confusion about gender identity, was on the list of a number of physical and psychological conditions that make you ineligible for military service. It is most unfortunate. You have to have compassion for people who are confused about their gender identity. But in the military, it is a readiness issue because treatments are extensive, very time-consuming, very expensive for surgeries when surgeries are involved. It's something that puts heavier burdens on everyone else. It's a step too far to say this particular faction, just this one, is so politically correct that it's going to be treated differently than other conditions that make you ineligible for military service.
Right. And one can anticipate that the people with flat feet will be in court demanding entry too. Elaine Donnelly, so much more to talk about. I look forward to doing so with you early and often in this year. Thank you so much for joining us today and for your great work, including a lot of it through the holiday weekend on this particular issue of transgender. Check out that work at cmrlink.org, the Center for Military Readiness. Elaine, thank you so much. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about the latest out of North Korea, China, and Pakistan right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined for the first time in 2018 by our friend and colleague Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving Asia, who is a columnist with the Daily Beast. He is an active contributor on Fox News and in so many other outlets to the public policy debate about the developments that are, I suspect, going to, if anything, only intensify in their importance to us in the new year. Gordon, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back, and a most happy new year to you.
Happy new year, Frank. And Frank, what you do is absolutely critical to the safety and security of the American people. So thank you so much for letting me be on your program. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Let me ask you, Gordon, first and foremost, I guess we've got to get a stock taking about the country that you've written about in your best-selling book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. We've had new threats from the North, the opening of, it appears, talks between the North and the South, Chinese activities in connection with all of this. Give us sort of a lay of the land as we head into 2018.
So much happened in the last few days. The most important thing is Kim Jong-un's New Year's address. He's been doing this every year. And this year, he said two things which are important to us. First of all, he said that on his desk is a nuclear button, but he also indicated that really their arsenal is only for deterrence. I think that he has been unnerved by President Trump's statements about attacking North Korea. The North Koreans right now just want to make sure that they can develop their arsenal in peace. This is going to be one of the big themes going forward about what the United States can do to stop Kim short of the use of force. The other thing, though, Kim extended an overture to South Korea, specifically talking about sending North Korean athletes to the Winter Olympics, which will be held next month, not that far from Seoul. And the people in South Korea are very pleased about that. But we've got to be concerned because President Moon Jae-in of South Korea is a Korean nationalist. He wants to move South Korea closer to China and North Korea and away from the United States. And the Olympics gives Kim Jong-un an opportunity to really pry Seoul away from the alliance.
Well, you call him a nationalist, Gordon Chang. It seems to me he's a leftist, first and foremost, and the alignment or realignment that you've indicated he's interested in has been worrying to us since he came to power. And I guess this is really the first move by the North Koreans to begin exploiting that. Gordon, you had an interesting turn of phrase there. The North Koreans just want to be able to build their arsenal in peace. You know, the trouble is that the arsenal is, unfortunately, by Kim Jong-un's own admission, a threat to this country and a growing one at that. This brings us to the role that the Chinese seem to be playing, a double game, I think is fair to say, at best, with respect to that North Korean threat to the United States. Our friend and colleague Bill Gertz has got an important piece in the Washington Free Beacon today. It is reportedly a document from the internal councils of the Chinese government that lays out this double game with respect to North Korea. They're going to go through the motions of sanctioning them, but they're actually going to arm them further in ways that will be more dangerous for us. We can't attest at this point to the authenticity of this document, of course, Gordon, but does this sound right to you? And if so, is President Trump right to be concerned about Chinese offloading, giving the North Koreans Chinese oil, I should say? And, you know, again, what is the ground truth?
As you point out, we don't know the authenticity of this document, but I think that's almost beside the point because this document does describe accurately China's policies toward North Korea and the United States, its policies on enforcement of sanctions, and also its proliferation of ballistic missile technology and equipment to the North Koreans. So I think what we should be doing is looking at China at what they're actually in fact doing. And this document fortunately lays it all out very clearly. The one thing that China's been doing with North Korea, and it becomes clear as you go through this document, is that they're using North Korea as the paw, using it to destabilize the region, to push the United States out of Asia, and a number of other things. Although Kim talks about deterrence, we've got to be concerned that, and people often say, and a lot of Americans say this, oh, you know, Kim Jong-un just wants to be able to keep his regime in place. He's not going to use the nukes. We don't know that. But more important, we do know that he's going to use the prospect of the destruction of American cities to break the alliance between Washington and Seoul, get our troops off the peninsula so that he can then go ahead and intimidate South Korea into submission. You know, people say, okay, Kim wants regime survival. Yes, that's true, of course. But he defines regime survival as taking over South Korea, because he always talks about this. This is the core goal of the Kim family. If he doesn't make progress toward it, the North Korean people are not going to sacrifice for the regime. So we've got to remember that regime survival in North Korean terms is very different than what we think of, and that this is really a very aggressive policy, and he will use the prospect of nuclear war to achieve his aim.
And Gordon, I guess I just want to emphasize the point you made about the Chinese seeing it is in their interest to have him be able to continue to do so. And the idea that we're going to get their help, let alone their decisive help in dealing with this threat, is, I think, fatuous and increasingly dangerous. As Donald Trump tweeted, I believe, over the holidays, the opportunity for a friendly solution certainly is seemingly now less and less in prospect. Let me ask you about one other thing. Speaking of Donald Trump's tweets, just today, Gordon, he launched his first salvo of the new year against Pakistan in what can only be described as, well, undiplomatic language. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this. The Pakistanis are very upset. But for many of us, it's a breath of fresh air, speaking quite truthfully about another double game, at best, that the Pakistanis have been playing. Talk a little bit about the tweet, the context, and where we go from here.
Yeah, this was a refreshing blast from President Trump. Someone in the official reaches in Washington had to say this, and it's good that he said this now. Essentially, what he did was he lambasted Pakistan and his first tweet of the year, basically saying that over the course of decades, we have given the Pakistanis $33 billion in aid, and in return, they've given us, as he said, nothing but lies and deceit. I think it's more important right now that we focus on changing our Pakistan policy, and actually talking the truth is really the first step in a long process of untangling ourselves from Islamabad, because our policies over the course of time have not really benefited the United States in the way that we thought. And this is truth-telling. People may or may not think it's a great idea to do this by Twitter. I think it's a perfect idea to do this by Twitter, because we need to signal not only to Islamabad, but also the Chinese who are using the Pakistanis, like they're using the North Koreans, by the way. We need to signal to all of these countries that we're just not going to take this anymore.
Tough love, as they say, at the very least. Gordon, quickly, we don't have time to do justice to this, but since we last talked, I believe, the president unveiled his new national security strategy. And I'd be very interested in sort of your quick take on it as it relates specifically to the area of the world that you focus on most closely, Asia.
Here again is the president speaking truth, because he identifies China and Russia, not as partners, not as friends, as President Obama did and President Bush before him. But he says, look, they're adversaries. And he lays out a strategy for countering the threats from Beijing and Moscow. This is good. As again, it's the first step in actually putting U.S. policy on a much better plane. And the great thing about this national security strategy is also it is consistent with what he said on the campaign trail. You know, too often you get presidents, once they're in office, they issue an NSS, as these documents are called, which have bear no relation to what he said as he was campaigning for office. This one is consistent. There are a lot of things in it I don't like, but nonetheless, this is an important document. I believe it will be considered historic, and it puts the U.S. on the right path with regard to Russia and China.
Well, this will be the subject for many more conversations in the weeks ahead. Gordon, as always, I appreciate all that you do for this program and look forward to a very, very successful exchange with you each week. Thank you for your contributions to Secure Freedom Radio and all of the others that you make to our country. Thank you. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. We'll take a look at the economic warfare element of the president's new national security strategy and what that might mean for you right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert at the Center for Security Policy on matters involving economic warfare. I'm happy to say he is a go-to guy for an awful lot of other people as well. In fact, it sounds as though the President of the United States has been reading his stuff, because in his national security strategy released shortly before Christmas, a very considerable emphasis was placed on the sorts of things Kevin has been talking about, warning of, and making important recommendations about for quite some time. Specifically, the importance of economic security to the national security of the United States, and the need to recognize that there are those hostile to us who are using economic warfare against us, and well, at least implicitly, we better be prepared to do the same. Kevin Freeman, I hope that was a Christmas present for you as it was for the rest of us. Welcome back. It's good to have you. Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you, Frank. Happy New Year to you. I was very pleased to hear the president's strategy. The National Security Report has a America First element to it. It's strong in economics. It recognizes the modern world that we're in. And so, yes, it was very pleasing. It was a great Christmas present.
Well, when you look at the challenges of our time, Kevin, and there are many that I look forward to talking with you about in the year ahead as we have in the past, one of the prominent ones, of course, is what is happening in Iran at the moment. I talked earlier in the program with Claire Lopez about things that the United States could do that might encourage regime change in Iran, which is clearly in our interest as well as that of the Iranian people. Interestingly enough, a friend of mine commented that one of the things that would greatly help on the ground in Iran at the moment, Kevin, is that if the United States government were to release what it knows about the lengths that prominent figures in the Iranian government have gone to stash their ill-gotten wealth, at least some of which is money that is not being made available to the Iranian people and causing them great privation, it would greatly inflame the animosity towards the regime and perhaps further catalyze this sort of transformation that we hope will come out of these protests. What are your thoughts on that as a sort of economic warfare instrument, and what others are there available to us?
Well, for one thing, the Iranian people need to know that this very wealthy nation, they have a lot of wealth in the form of oil revenues, has been squandered through the past several decades on all sorts of ridiculous things that are harmful to the world. When the Iranian people realize that they have been put in this position despite their wealth by the existing regime, and that they're being denied the opportunity to live in the modern world in so many ways, they should rise up. They are rising up, and they do rise up occasionally, only this time the president's response is different than President Obama's response, and recognizing we'd love to have you a part of the global community. We'd love the Iranian people to enjoy the wealth that's been developed in the world over the past several decades and for them to participate. The response that the President Trump has given is 180-degree different from President Obama, and I think it's a hugely positive step. once the Iranian people recognize that this massive amount of wealth has been sold on world markets in the form of oil, and it's been stashed in, you know, it's just like communism. You've said, you know, radical Islam is communism with a god, but it's the same thing. The few elitists gather all the wealth. And for people to recognize that it's been stolen from them, I think is a huge positive step.
It is one of these things that I pray we will see the president going beyond rhetoric to actually exercise the power that he has and that we as a nation have to help shape events on the ground in Iran. We can't do it by ourselves, but I think we can certainly help those who are in the streets. Let me ask you about China. I was speaking earlier with Gordon Chang about this revelation by Bill Gertz, Kevin Freeman, that is to the effect the Chinese have actually been doing what Donald Trump called them out for the other day, which is end-running the sanctions that they vote for at the United Nations. This secret memo from apparently the high reaches of the Chinese government, if it's authentic, certainly attests to what they've been doing. Not a surprise, given the interests of the North Koreans and the Chinese to maintain this strategic partnership. But Kevin Freeman, again, what could we be doing that we're not at the moment to try to impose real costs to the Chinese for playing this double game?
Well, China's got this incredible economic warfare strategy. It's built on two elements, data and debt. So they hack everything and then they loan money to governments to force them to bend to their will. They have a client state in North Korea. This memo, if it's true, documents and proves that. North Korea has operated with full Chinese support, even though they want to pretend to the world that they're not behind the North Korean regime. They're standing with the world against the development of nuclear weapons and so forth. What we need to do is acknowledge that we're in this economic war, acknowledge that they're hacking everything, acknowledge that they're really literally have a economic warfare strategy to take over and call them out on it. And we need to force the world community to acknowledge this as well. It's going to be very difficult because, like I shared, they've loaned money to countries around the world, cheap debt, and then they call it. It's a form of their power exercise. And it's something that we've got to be prepared to address.
As we do as well, perhaps in this year of 2018, the intensifying Chinese ambitions to displace our currency as the world's reserve currency. It's going to be a very dynamic portfolio that you specialize in, Kevin Freeman. The author, by the way, of two best-selling books on the subject, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. I encourage you to check them out, as well as his website, globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, lastly, let me ask you, the end game is at hand, it appears, in the middle of this month, for Congress to fashion some sort of spending arrangement for the rest of the year. It's widely expected that there will be some sort of DACA deal included in that omnibus spending bill. It will presumably involve a measure of amnesty, at least for the 700,000 or 800,000 folks who are considered to be young adults, according to this Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program. What is your estimation, Kevin Freeman, looking at this just from an economic point of view, of the implications of that amnesty in the absence of something that keeps more people from simply coming here and asking for the same thing?
Well, you Milton Friedman said it best. He said, you can have a social welfare state or you can have open borders. You can't have both. In the absence of a willingness to tighten our belt fiscally and to reduce our social welfare programs, our health care and everything else, we cannot move towards open borders. You don't put a clamp down on the number of people coming here and you offer, for example, Bernie Sanders free college for everyone. Who in the world wouldn't come to America for free college? We're on an unsustainable fiscal path as it is. This just accelerates that path so dramatically that we bankrupt our nation.
Well, we have to stave that off. I hope that all of you in our audience and millions of Americans beyond will be using this opportunity, this next few days, perhaps week or two, to communicate to your elected representatives that you do not want DACA to provide an amnesty, at least until there is in place means of preventing more people from coming here and trying to demand the same thing. Kevin Freeman, as always, your insights and leadership on these matters is tremendously appreciated. Kevin Freeman is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. I'm very pleased to say we'll look forward to talking with you often in 2014. Kevin, meantime, again, Happy New Year to you. And to all of you out there, I hope you'll continue to celebrate it by joining us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.